A whole new power grid today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Hurricane Irma left millions without power in Florida and across the Caribbean. All eyes now look to see how America rebuilds and upgrades its power grid.
What we're going to roll out here over the next 10, 15, 20 years, you're going to see many, many other parts of the world look to.
But new technologies require trained workers. This former coal miner in West Virginia is now installing solar panels.
I love solar. It's way better than coal, I think.
Plus, a man agrees to take in his nephew, an undocumented miner. Then immigration officials knock on his door and hand him a letter.
It says you need to come in and talk about conspiracy, smuggling and harboring illegal aliens, and visa fraud.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Young people caught up in the back and forth over America's immigration policies. That's what our two top stories have in common today. In a moment, we'll hear from Janet Napolitano, one of the architects of President Obama's DACA program. But we start with reporter Hannah Dreyer. We used to speak with Hannah almost every week when she was the AP correspondent in Caracas, Venezuela. She's got a new beat covering immigration for ProPublica here in the U.S. And recently, Hannah wrote a story about a man named Edwin. It's such a compelling and, frankly, worrying story. We called up Hannah on Skype to talk about it.
Edwin has lived in the U.S. legally for 15 years. He immigrated from El Salvador. And this summer, his nephew came up. He came up illegally on trains and in the back of tractor trailers. And Edwin got a call from the government this summer asking if he could take this nephew in while the nephew's case goes through the asylum process. So Edwin said, sure. He went out and he bought a bed. And then later that week, he got a call from ICE that said, you need to come in and talk to us about smuggling and harboring illegal aliens, basically accusing him of smuggling his own nephew.
How can they do this? I mean, it seems like Edwin is being set up.
Edwin himself said that to me, like, is this entrapment? Why would the government tell me to take in my relative? His nephew was just 17 when he was picked up this summer. And then turn around and say, why do you have this illegal alien in your home? And this is something that people across the country are experiencing now with the change in ICE policy around guardians who take in unaccompanied minors.
So what's going on, Hannah? What is ICE actually doing?
Well, under the Obama administration, ICE had kind of a blanket policy that it wouldn't target guardians who came forward to take unaccompanied minors. The U.S. government needs to find somewhere for these kids to come when they come up here and have asylum claims that are going through the system. So guardians were kind of helping the government out, taking these kids off of the government's hands, and the government was saying, look, we're not going to look too much into your legal status. We're not going to target you. And with Trump, all of that has changed. The administration is now not only targeting people who come forward to take in relatives for immigration violations, but they're also now saying that they're going to target those relatives as smugglers.
That must be really terrifying for a lot of people who are in that situation.
Yeah, and what some former ICE agents have told me is that that's the idea. They say that ICE has been pushing for this for a long time, in part to crack down on smuggling, but in part to get the word out that if you are trying to come up to the U.S. illegally, you shouldn't count on your family to take you in, because your family might feel pressure to distance themselves from you to avoid bringing ICE down on their own heads.
And is it, in fact, ICE that is warning the people in question and then coming after them? Are we talking about two different agencies or two different parts that are not communicating with each other within ICE?
Yeah, that's exactly the right question, because it is two different agencies. There's the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is the agency that's in charge of making sure young immigrants are placed in normal homes when possible. And then there's ICE's enforcement wing. And you have detectives from ICE going after the same people that the Office of Refugee Resettlement are trying to reassure and convince to take on these young kids. And we're hearing off the record from people who work in the resettlement part of the government that this is creating big problems for them, because they used to reassure people that they could take in a kid and not worry. Mm-hmm. But now they don't feel comfortable doing that.
So at ICE, the left hand isn't talking to the right hand. Is that fair?
Exactly. And the fear is that this could put us in a situation where we have a lot more kids who just languish in detention.
So you talked about a policy change. Are we talking about a few cases here, or do you really believe that what we're seeing is a policy change at ICE?
ICE told me that over the course of 2 months this summer, they arrested more than 400 people as a direct result of this change in implementation.
That's incredible. Just this summer?
Just over 2 months this summer.
So just back to Edwin, because he told you something interesting and something that indicates he doesn't actually regret taking in his nephew, even with ICE coming after him. What did he say?
That's right. He says he couldn't have said no to his sister's son. Their family and family has to look out for each other.
Hannah Dreyer with ProPublica. Great to speak with you, Hannah. Thank you.
Good talking with you, Mirka.
Then there are DACA recipients, another group of young immigrants facing an uncertain future under President Trump. They've been protected from deportation by the Obama-era Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA. Now they could face deportation as Trump phases the program out, unless Congress passes new legislation to shield them again. Janet Napolitano led the U.S. Department of Homeland Security when DACA began. She's now president of the University of California system. And Napolitano and the UC system are suing the Trump administration over its decision to end DACA.
We're suing because we have thousands of students who are enrolled in DACA. We have employees who are enrolled in DACA. They are valued members of our university community, and we believe that the decision to end the program is wrong. It's wrong on the law, it's bad policy, and it's inconsistent with our values.
You were actually the author of the DACA program, so can you just take us back to that moment, remind us what was going on, and describe what went into the decision to do that executive action?
We started DACA in the wake of Congress's inability to pass meaningful immigration legislation, specifically a DREAM Act. So we at Department of Homeland Security, when I was there, undertook the legal analysis and the administrative action necessary to remove these young people from the fear of deportation.
Leading up to that legal analysis, was there a kind of a eureka moment where you and President Obama realized there might actually be a way to protect these young people?
There was a moment, and it was in my office as secretary when I had asked the staff what could we do for these young people, and they came in with a suggestion involving only those young people who were already in deportation proceedings, of which there were very few. And I said, well, what about a program by which all of them would be eligible to apply for deferred action? And that was kind of the eureka moment, and we put the lawyers to work, worked up the legal basis for doing what became DACA, and we worked up the administrative procedures that would be necessary to do it.
What do you say to critics of DACA who argue that it was designed as a short-term solution, but by being renewable, it is in some ways kind of a permanent solution?
Well, I don't know that that's a criticism. I think that being subject to renewal simply restates that these individuals remain low priority from an enforcement perspective, and any deportation should rightfully be deferred, and they should be eligible to work in the United States.
How hopeful are you that if DACA does go away, it'll be replaced by something legislated by Congress that's more permanent and just as beneficial for young people?
Well, we're going to continue to advocate that Congress take some action. So in a way, this is a belt and suspenders approach. We're seeking judicial relief, but we're also seeking congressional action. Those things are not inconsistent at all. And, you know, anything that can be done to save DACA and to provide some relief for its recipients is worth going for.
Janet Napolitano, the former head of the Department of Homeland Security, now the president of the University of California. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Okay, shifting gears now. Australians have until the end of this month to turn in their illegal guns, no questions asked. After that, Australians who possess an unregistered firearm face potentially stiff punishments, up to 14 years in jail and fines in excess of $200,000. The gun amnesty started on July 1st, and since then, more than 26,000 illegal firearms have been turned in. Matt Young is a reporter with Australia's The News website. What is this amnesty actually hoping to achieve, Matt?
Hi, Marco. Look, this is a key outcome of the Lind Cafe siege review.
Yeah, just remind us of that briefly.
So the Lind Cafe siege, it was our most recent terror attack. It happened in December of 2014,
right,
and two people were killed. So there was this report that was handed down in May, and it concluded that the gun that was used by the gunman was obtained on the illicit market. And this coronial report, it warned that such firearms could remain in circulations for decades. So basically, all the states and territories got together and they basically put up this amnesty. So, yeah, it's been a pretty big thing over here. 26,000 firearms have been handed in as of September 8.
What kind of weapons are we talking about?
It's a lot of sort of family heirlooms. We're hearing of, you know, guns from the 1850s, Luger pistols from World War I, revolvers from World War II, shotguns from the Vietnam War. But we've also had things like grenades handed in. So it's all types.
Yeah, explain the incentive here. You aren't punished if you hand in your unregistered firearm now. So after the amnesty is lifted at the end of September, what are the penalties in Australia?
So it's illegal to own an unregistered gun. The maximum fine is you can spend 14 years in prison, or you can have a fine of up to $280,000 if you're caught. So this is kind of like the authority saying, it's okay, you know, we won't charge you, we won't hold you in account for holding these firearms. It's okay if you hand them in, nothing will happen.
What's been the public response to this amnesty? Are there people who see it as an infringement on their freedom to own guns?
We have such a different culture in Australia when it comes to guns. You know, it's all the states and territories, you know, have welcomed the deal. You know, the opposition have welcomed the deal. The general public, we're pretty open about this sort of thing too. You know, we like to sort of see this thing happening. We don't have so much of a gun culture as you might do in the United States.
Is there an organization with the same amount of lobbying power in Australia as the National Rifle Association here in the US?
No, we don't really have that. I'm sure that, you know, we obviously have associations around, but nothing quite as powerful as the NRA, for sure.
Yeah, and Matt, you used to work in the US. Why do you think Australia's attitude to firearms, why do you think the culture there is so different from the United States?
I worked in New York City from 2014 to 2016, and to be honest, I never thought about guns really before that. And at that time, it was really interesting because, you know, we were seeing a lot of the terror attacks happen as well across the world. And all of a sudden, it was sort of really in my conscience. And, you know, I remember sitting on the train one day and looking at a man, and he had his hand in his pocket, and I thought he could be holding a gun. You know, like it was just very surreal to me because in Australia, we just don't think that way. It's not really on our radar.
But it's interesting because these two amnesties that you've talked about, the one that is currently going on in Australia and the one a few years ago, both kind of came out of mass shootings. It was like that was the response. Mass shooting, let's buy back guns.
Yeah, absolutely. Although this time it's not a buyback. So the first game, that was a buyback, and that cost $230 million, but we bought back over 650,000 firearms, and that was paid by increased taxes.
So with this seemingly successful amnesty, seems to be somewhat successful if you just go by numbers, what lessons do you think there are for us here in the United States?
I think the United States sort of needs to be open to discussion and sort of admit that there is a problem. For us, the buyback scheme really worked, and I would say I would welcome it for the United States as well.
Matt Young is a reporter with The News website in Australia. Thanks so much for your time, Matt.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Looking beyond coal to solar in a coal state. You're with The World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The World in Words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The World in Words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Today, for our 50 state series, we're visiting West Virginia. By many measures, West Virginia is one of the poorest states in the country. Its economy has long been reliant on coal, and coal is used in the steelmaking process. But when steelmaking largely shifted overseas, West Virginia's coal industry took a big hit. Now it's under pressure again as the U.S. turns increasingly to cleaner, cheaper sources of energy. And that's left many in West Virginia looking beyond coal. The World's Jason Margolis has this profile of a startup that's bringing a very different set of jobs to the state.
Tanner Lee Swagger graduated from high school this spring. His father and his grandfather both worked in West Virginia's coal industry. I asked Swagger if any of his classmates were going the coal route.
No.
None.
None.
What are most of your friends doing now?
Honestly, working, I know, fast food, and we're not working at all.
We have those new socket adapters.
Yeah.
All right, sounds good.
I met Swagger at his job installing rooftop solar panels. He says his family is delighted.
Oh, they love it. They're happy. They're excited that I'm actually doing something different. You know, a lot of people ain't doing this in West Virginia. A lot of people's against it, actually. A lot of people want to go back to coal.
And obviously you're not against it, right?
No, I ain't against it. I love solar. It's way better than coal, I think.
Solar panels can save people money on their electricity bills and cut down on greenhouse gas emissions, which fuel climate change. Swagger is working as an apprentice with Solar Hauler. 32-year-old Dan Conant founded the company 4 years ago. He doesn't see solar and coal at odds with each other.
The way I think about it as a West Virginian is that West Virginia has always been an energy state, and this is just the next step.
Don't let the accent fool you. He's a native.
I've been told so many times that you don't sound like a West Virginian because I don't have a thick twang or, yeah.
Conant left his job at the U.S. Department of Energy to start Solar Hauler to try to help slow his state's economic slide.
Mingo County, West Virginia, which is where I think three of our crew members are coming out of today, they've lost more than 40% of all the jobs in the entire county in the past 4 years.
Only about 12,000 West Virginians work in coal mining today, a 90% decline over two generations. President Trump has made bringing back coal jobs an outsized part of his Make America Great Again platform. Conant is grateful for the spotlight on the economic plight of Appalachia, but he doesn't see a return to the good old days either.
We need to find new things. It's not going to be the coal industry of the past. The industry has been so automated. Strip mining doesn't take the number of people that guys with headlamps and pickaxes did.
Solar may be an energy of tomorrow, but coal jobs pay much better. Solar panel installers earn about $12 an hour. Coal mining jobs here typically pay more than double that. But those jobs are increasingly hard to find, and Solar Hauler needs workers now. It's setting up a training center in an old abandoned factory in Huntington, West Virginia. Deacon Stone with Solar Hauler shows me around.
This was Corbin Clothing Manufacturer. They made some of the finest, like, Mad Men era clothing that you could get straight up from Wall Street, New York City. It was all across the country.
He stops the tour and points at something bizarre. Rows and rows of church pews.
So we're in Appalachia, you know, and you can't throw a rock and not hit a church or a place that will soon be a church, right? So these pews came from a local...
Long story short, they needed seating in a hurry.
And we had no means to purchase chairs, no means to borrow things, and it was just like we're sweating. And I pass by and I see these pews, and it's like deep discount if you take them all.
Solar Hauler is partnering with a nonprofit called the Coalfield Development Corporation. They own the building. Beyond solar jobs, they're teaching former coal workers skills like woodworking and farming. Apprentices with Coalfield Development work 33 hours and spend 6 hours a week at a community college. About 90 people have entered the program. Brandon Dennison is the group's CEO.
Coal is more than just an employment base. Here in Appalachia, I mean, it's central to our identity. And that lets you know a sense of our pain the last few years. No one industry can replace coal, nor should it. We need to diversify and have lots of different business opportunities.
Half of Coalfield Development's funding, nearly $2 million, comes from a federal program called the Appalachian Regional Commission. It was created by an act of Congress in 1965 at the urging of Presidents John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. to combat the region's high levels of poverty. The Trump administration wants to defund it. Dennison says that worries him a lot.
If we lost our Appalachian Regional Commission funding, we would have to basically cut our scale of impact in half.
Here's how the mayor of Huntington sees potential funding cuts.
Well, it's stupid.
Steve Williams is a Democrat and is running for Congress next year. Proponents of the Appalachian Regional Commission say it's helped dramatically cut rural poverty, improve regional health care and education. Opponents say it's a waste of taxpayer money. President Trump's budget calls for the elimination of, quote, unnecessary federal funding, citing a 1996 government study casting doubt on the commission's effectiveness. President Ronald Reagan also tried to defund it repeatedly, by the way. Mayor Williams says pulling the plug on the Appalachian Regional Commission would send a clear message.
That says to me that they're giving up on this area.
For now, Congress has voted to restore the program's funding through the end of the year. Dan Conant, the founder of Solar Hauler, stays clear of politics. He's interested in market economics. And at the end of the day, he thinks he's betting on a winner.
Within a week of cutting the ribbon on our very first project, we got so much interest around the state that we outstripped the capacity of everybody who knew how to install solar in West Virginia at that point.
Conant says he's currently backed up on 16 projects, and he needs trained workers to get things moving along. For The World, Jason Margolis, Lewisburg, West Virginia.
Jason's story is part of our 50 state series exploring how globalization has been affecting communities across the U.S. We're 7 states in. You can check out the whole series over at PRI.org. Meanwhile, hundreds of millions of miles away from Earth, official news from NASA, the Cassini spacecraft has started its final descent towards Saturn. On Friday, the probe's mission will be completed when it plunges into the atmosphere of Saturn and disintegrates. NASA launched Cassini almost 20 years ago on a mission to study the complex gaseous makeup of Saturn. That mission has been hugely successful. 13 years ago, Cassini entered Saturn's orbit, and since then, it's been delivering images and scientific data about the planet, its rings, and its moons. I have one of the high-resolution images as my screensaver here at work. Those rings are mind-blowing in high def. And even though the probe is about to be destroyed, analyzing all the data it sent will still take years. Here's what Nick Achilios of Imperial College London told our friends at the BBC. Nick is one of the scientists working on that data.
Well, after the spacecraft itself is destroyed, of course, it's far from the end of the story, because although we have been analyzing data and interpreting data as the mission has been proceeding, Cassini has orbited Saturn hundreds of times, and to really fully exploit that scientific data set, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say it's going to take many more years to come, possibly even decades to come, where we'll be looking at those data sets at, you know, in finer and finer detail to extract as much science from them as we can.
As I said, Cassini is due to crash into Saturn's atmosphere on Friday. My WGBH colleague Ari Daniel will be at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California when it happens. So tune in here Friday to hear him describe this historic moment in space exploration.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. In the midst of Hurricane Irma, Cubans craved a friendly face, a reassuring voice. And I'm not talking about Fidel or Raul.
All over social media, the Cubans started asking, where is Rubiera?
That would be Jose Rubiera, Cuba's most trusted weatherman. Stick around and hear his story, only on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The pictures from Havana were easy to miss this weekend as Florida dealt with Irma's unwelcome arrival. But in the Cuban capital, too, there were flooded streets and residents wading through water above their waists. Hurricane Irma also slammed Havana's legendary Seafront Boulevard with waves nearly 40 feet high. Irma was the most powerful hurricane to hit the island in 80 years. And as the storm approached last weekend, many Cubans were switching on their televisions to catch a glimpse of a familiar, reassuring face. And it wasn't Fidel Castro they were looking for.
They were hoping to see Jose Rubiera, the top weatherman in Cuba.
That's journalist and editor Gail Reed. She's based in Cuba, but left just as Irma was closing in on the island. I asked her why so many Cubans look to this meteorologist, Jose Rubiera, for reassurance.
He has been with Cubans over the decades during every storm, every hurricane, every threat meteorologically to the island. And all over social media, the Cubans started asking, where is Rubiera? And as it turned out, he was stuck in the Miami airport, desperately trying to get back. Because although he's retired officially, every time there's a major storm, he is on TV and radio from the meteorological station in Havana.
Yes, so why is he so beloved in Cuba?
Well, he's so beloved because he's a scientist. He's not a stick figure they put before a map. He teaches you ask everybody, a taxi driver in Cuba can tell you about the Saffir-Simpson scale of hurricanes, tell you which part of the hurricane is most dangerous for the wind, most dangerous for the rain. They trust him because he teaches them, and he teaches them very early, before the hurricane even hits. So that's why they were already missing him. Comfort and the trust come because he gives them the information they need. You know, Cuba's a highly literate society, so people thrive on information. For example, I was watching one of his forecasts during the storm, and he said, a lot of you are worried about Hurricane Jose. I want to reassure you that Hurricane Jose is not a danger to Cuba. Here's where it's going to go. He uses all of the different projections from NOAA, from the U.S., has a great relationship with the Miami Meteorology Center. And so he's also been a person who is very open to relations with the United States and to helping each other during storms.
So let's just have a taste of Jose Rubiera's weather forecast on TV.
Bueno, estamos para darle la última información acerca de este peligroso huracán que está cruzando por la callería norte.
So, yeah, I can hear a reassurance in his voice. You've met him, right? Is he like that in person?
Oh, yeah, he's a really wonderful person. But he's also just a Cuban who cares about other Cubans and actually cares about people across the Florida Straits. He's been essential to this collaboration that Cuba has managed to attain with the Miami weather forecasters. And in fact, some of the U.S. TV stations in Spanish were using his reports in this last hurricane. He's trusted on beyond Cuba.
So Cubans are relieved that Jose Rubiera is back on the air, but the news coming out of Cuba is not good. I know you're heading back there and you've been in touch with family and friends. What are they telling you about the situation now and what it's like today?
The flooding has been horrific in Havana. My neighborhood now has lights and other neighborhoods south have lights. Of course, the hardest hit were those closer to the Seaside Drive, the Malecón, where the waves were just, you can see some of the photographs. They look like they're at the top of the Morro Castle Lighthouse.
Wow.
I mean, they were just huge.
Cuba's health professionals work throughout the Caribbean, and Cuba is sending medical help now to its neighbors. Can you tell us about that? Is it depriving Cuba of its own doctors?
No, not really. They have 85,000 doctors. They have about 60,000 abroad now, 700 of them in other Caribbean countries. And there's a team of about 20-some in Barbuda, which, of course, was the island probably worst hit by the storm. Right after Irma hit Cuba, they sent a team of linemen to restore electricity in Barbuda, to help restore their electrical grid, which, of course, is also one of the hardest hit in Cuba itself. You know, we don't have all those great supplies from Home Depot and other places that they have in the States, but people help each other during storms.
Gail Reed is the founder of Medic and the editor of Medic Review. Thank you very much for your time and safe travels back to Havana.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to getting back.
In Florida, more than half of the state's population lost power because of Irma, and many of the millions of Floridians affected will have to wait weeks before that power is restored. Here's what one of Florida's utility representatives told ABC over the weekend.
What we think we'll see on the West Coast is a wholesale rebuild of our electric grid.
That'd be the West Coast, the Gulf Coast of Florida. So how can the state rebuild to avoid mass blackouts in the future? We put that question to Francis O'Sullivan. He's the director of research for the MIT Energy Initiative. But before we get to how to fix the system, I asked him to explain how the electrical grid here in the U.S. actually works.
At one end, you have a generation station, a power station. There, the fuel is converted to electricity. That electricity is fed into typically a high-voltage transmission line. So those are the very big towers, the pylons that you see crisscrossing the country. And that kind of serves as the highways for electricity. And that feeds electricity to substations where the voltage is stepped down to the levels that we can distribute amongst, across suburbs and so on.
So as we just heard, representatives from Florida's utility companies say parts of the state's electrical grid are going to need a wholesale rebuild. What changes would make the system more resilient to natural disasters?
So for a long, long time, really, the rebuild would just be putting up what we have in place already, maybe thinking about concrete posts, etc. But something different is now available. We have this new suite of technologies that are allowing us to develop what we're calling microgrids or mesogrids. Mm. And this is where we bring generation, energy storage, so big batteries, and distribution into a new structure, more like islands of power service. And in Florida, in that case, they're going to be looking to bring more of that type of technology to the state.
Can you explain briefly how would that actually make the system more resilient?
Right, absolutely. So one of the big challenges with this kind of vertical system that I described earlier is that if one key artery, one of these key transmission lines or substations is damaged by, let's say, a falling tree, then you could have hundreds of thousands of people without service. These microgrids, they take a different approach. What you're doing really is you're bringing some of the generation and storage to local areas, and you're servicing in a radial sense that local area from one central region. And what happens, or what will happen in an instance like a hurricane, is that one region might get damaged, so the generation might be knocked out. That system's going to be able to break away from the others, and those other local systems, they're going to be able to continue to deliver service to their customers.
What you're describing sounds a lot like the internet, where one kind of strand of the network goes down, but there are enough kind of bridges to reconnect it.
That's a superb analogy, actually, yes.
Where in the world can we look to for good examples of grids that have been conceived of more like the internet, whereby if one network goes down, another can be connected to and everyone still gets service?
You know, there aren't any real kind of ubiquitous examples of countries with this kind of new technology rolled out, as I've described. We're all at that point now where we're stepping into this new space where these technologies are more viable for utilities. So what we're really seeing is momentum across the world. But the United States is really going to be at the forefront of bringing the innovations that are important for defining these new opportunities to the market. And so what we're going to roll out here over the next 10, 15, 20 years, you're going to see many, many other parts of the world look to. And I will add this, you know, there are 1 billion people or more in this world without electricity today.
Right.
They're going to be looking to these types of new technologies to deliver the energy services that they want, that they deserve, frankly.
I think of a little place like Barbuda, which was completely, basically completely destroyed in Hurricane Irma. Don't you think that other countries might look to little places like Barbuda to see how they completely reinstall a new system?
Well, I think if you look at Barbuda, they are going to step away from this event, and they're probably going to come back and say, look, we have now the opportunity to actually make each individual home its own little power station, effectively, a fully distributed, you know, in the true sense, a distributed system. And, you know, it's because of a lot of hard work and a lot of ingenuity over the last decade or so in the renewable space that we have that opportunity. People are going to be able to install solar systems and batteries that are becoming increasingly cost effective in their individual homes. Those homes are still going to be wired together, but it will be possible for homes to break away, much like the bigger microgrids, and to be able to self-serve during these kind of very challenging weather events.
Francis O'Sullivan is Director of Research for the MIT Energy Initiative. Thanks very much for coming in.
Absolute pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
The map of the Middle East might be changing if the Kurdish people of Iraq get their way. In 2 weeks, the Kurds will be holding a referendum on independence. The Kurds represent a distinct population within Iraq, in part because they have their own culture and language. U.S. veterans of the Iraq War tend to have a positive view of them. That's because the Kurds were eager volunteers in the fight against Saddam Hussein and then against al-Qaeda in Iraq. The Kurds have run their own affairs pretty much since 1991, but they've never had their own country. The referendum could change that. Ayub Nouri is an editor with the Kurdish news service, Rudau. So what is the point of this referendum? We hear it's a non-binding vote, so is it just designed to antagonize officials in Baghdad?
No, this referendum is not designed to antagonize Baghdad or any of the neighboring countries of the Kurdistan region. The vote is to let the more than 5 million Kurds who live in Iraq to decide whether they want to stay with this country or they want to separate and create a Kurdish independent state. And the Kurdish president, Masoud Barzani, Kurdish political parties who are behind the referendum project say this is a binding vote. After September 25th, if the majority of Kurds have decided to say yes and separate from Iraq, they will go through some negotiations with the central government, and hopefully there will be an independent Kurdish state.
So Baghdad sees it as non-binding, but the Kurds see it definitely as a binding vote.
Yes, Baghdad says it's not binding. Their parliament met today. They said they are against this referendum, and they hope that it's non-binding. But the Kurds who are going for the referendum say it is binding, and the Kurdish president has said that it's not just a referendum for the sake of it. It is for Kurdish independence.
So Baghdad, of course, is unhappy about this referendum, but do you know why?
Yes, Baghdad is not happy, and actually a few hours ago, the Iraqi parliament convened and they voted against the Kurdish referendum. They say the Kurdish referendum would lead to the disintegration of Iraq and the disintegration of Iraq's territorial integrity.
I mean, there's oil up there in Kurdistan as well. Don't you think the government in Baghdad is worried about losing that?
Yes, there is oil up in the Kurdish region that was discovered only a few years ago. But there is more oil in the rest of Iraq. I think the worry that that Iraqi leaders have is not they are going to lose some of the natural resources in the Kurdish region. It's just about the territorial integrity of the country.
Ayub, the Kurds have enjoyed effective self-governance within Iraq since 1991. You're Kurdish. What would full independence mean to you? What does it practically bring the Kurds they don't have now?
It's a good question. I think for the Kurds, when you read many articles and books or things about Kurdish independence, they try to put a long list of conditions that the timing is not right, the Kurds are in economic crisis, and the neighbors are not happy with this. But for millions of Kurds, including myself, this is not about economy. It's not about oil and gas and natural resources. It's about dignity. The Kurds have gained nothing from living with Iraq for 100 years other than the executions and persecution and mass killings. So full Kurdish independence means Kurds having their own flag. We want to have our own seat in the United Nations, the Kurdish passport, and for Kurds to be able to say they are from Kurdistan and not from Iraq. And most importantly, when you have a state, then you decide whether you want to join a war in the region or not. Because this region, especially Iraq, has been at war, has been in turmoil and problems for 100 years. But as long as you are part of Iraq, you are part of Iraq's problems too.
Ayub, you're heading to Kurdish territory tomorrow in advance of the referendum on the 25th. From what you're hearing, how do you suppose people will vote in favor of independence?
Yes, I think the majority of Kurds will vote yes in the referendum. And they have been holding one rally after another and with the music festivals and parties, not only in the Kurdistan region of Iraq, but among Kurdish communities in Europe and North America as well. So there is a lot of excitement because September 25th is basically a 100-year-long dream coming true for millions of Kurds.
Is there any danger that it could lead to some kind of confrontation between the Kurds and the central government in Baghdad, a violent confrontation?
Hopefully, yeah, there's always that fear. There's always that fear that Iraq, especially now, is run by militia groups. So there's the fear that there will be violence. But the answer is that there has always been violence, and this price has to be paid for independence sooner or later, or one way or another. But hopefully, there will not be any violence as a result of the Kurdish independence vote.
Ayub Nouri, editor with the Kurdish news service Rudau, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
By the way, Ayub Nouri's new book, Being Kurdish in a Hostile World, comes out next week. Aung San Suu Kyi is perhaps Myanmar's most famous person. Her long pro-democracy struggle earned her international praise and a Nobel Peace Prize, and that was before she finally led her political party to power in 2015. But that power comes with a tricky power-sharing arrangement with Myanmar's military. And that military, in recent months, it has engaged in a violent campaign against the Rohingya ethnic minority in Myanmar. Thousands of people have been killed, and so many have fled to Bangladesh that there are currently more Rohingyas there than in Myanmar. Poppy McPherson is a journalist based in Southeast Asia. She says that while Aung San Suu Kyi is facing international condemnation, including calls to strip her of her Nobel Prize, her politics are widely accepted domestically.
There are several theories which are sort of always put out there as to why she's not spoken up on behalf of the Rohingya. One of which is that she is afraid to do so because if she does so, then the military will very easily paint her as a Muslim sympathizer, which unfortunately in the country to sympathize with the Rohingya is very unpopular. The vast majority of Burmese people hold very strong views about the Rohingya. They're widely deemed to be illegal immigrants. Even very, very senior ministers within Aung San Suu Kyi's close circle have come out and said, well, we don't really know what you're talking about because the Rohingya are not an ethnic minority in Myanmar. Mm. So for her to come out and say this is wrong, she would not only potentially put herself in the position of alienating the military with whom she shares this very fragile balance of power, but also be alienating a large part of the country, really.
Mm.
But on the other hand, Aung San Suu Kyi is, you know, the de facto leader of the country. She's answering to the international community. She was such a voice for human rights for so long. It's perfectly natural that people are disappointed that she has sided with the military on this.
A few months ago, you wrote a profile of Aung San Suu Kyi for The Guardian. You spoke with several analysts and former advisors and other people who know her pretty well. What did they tell you about her personality and leadership style?
She's widely, you know, believed to be a very eloquent speaker, a very stubborn person, very single-minded in her drive to steer Myanmar's future. But it may be that she's not necessarily open to criticism. She's said to be very hostile to anybody who criticizes her. And so when organizations like the UN are coming out and saying, well, why aren't you doing anything about ethnic cleansing? So what people in Myanmar have been telling me is that she's becoming a little bit alienated by Western powers, which formerly kind of lauded her as a great advocate of human rights and are now pointing the finger at her.
Was there one diplomat who told you that he thought that Aung San Suu Kyi is closer to a Margaret Thatcher than we might believe?
Yes, exactly. The diplomat described Aung San Suu Kyi as a much more socially conservative leader than many people in the West expected. I think many people in the West expected her to be much more left-leaning than she actually is. She's a member of the Bamar majority, and so she's conservative in line with Burmese society, really.
There was a lot of hope in Myanmar when Aung San Suu Kyi's party took over the government after the election 2 years ago. With a Nobel laureate at the helm, freed from house arrest after many years, it seemed like the sky was the limit for Myanmar. Are people disillusioned now?
I think at the moment there's a sense of fear. There's a sense that this situation on the border, many people are very worried that it's going to become a national security threat, which you can argue that is of Myanmar's own making. Myanmar has oppressed these people for so long, kept them in camps, denied them the opportunities to go to higher education, to travel around freely. And now many people are afraid that they've become a national security threat. And the irony of that is very difficult.
That was Poppy McPherson, a reporter based in Southeast Asia. Another story now from Myanmar, because while some there stay silent, others just have to make some noise. Here's Lainey Baron from Yangon.
What if this is what woke you every day? And you tried to sleep through this at night? Myanmar can be a loud place. The country is making up for decades of isolation and military rule. There's traffic, there's construction, and there's this. A snack seller with a megaphone. It seems like everyone has a megaphone. Last year, a Dutch tourist unplugged a loudspeaker that was blasting outside his hotel. Thing is, he pulled the plug on a late-night Buddhist sermon. He was charged with interrupting a religious assembly. The tourist was jailed for 3 months with hard labor. He's been released, but his story went viral. And now more and more people are openly complaining about the megaphones.
It's really loud. It's too loud here.
This is Terrain Tan Cha. He's an artist. His latest project is a sound suit. It looks like a giant upright tube with colorful megaphones sticking out. When someone puts on the sound suit, all you can see is their feet. But you can certainly hear them. Terrain Tan Cha recently put 2 sound suits in a park, where anyone could make as much noise as they liked. Or they could turn the megaphones off without going to jail. But he's careful to say his sound suit isn't a direct response to the Dutch tourist case.
I think I don't know enough to say if arresting the foreigner was right or not. I think such a case is difficult.
Difficult as insensitive. Just talking about the Dutch tourist makes people nervous here. Slights against Buddhism, things like a Buddha tattoo, tend to rile up conservative religious factions. After the tourist turned off the loudspeaker, soldiers had to come and break up an angry mob outside his hotel. So when I asked Terrain Tan Cha about his sound suit, he stayed away from politics. He just wants to get people thinking. The sound suit repeats a looped noise until the batteries die or someone ducks inside to switch it off. Kids loved the sound suits. Couples in the park, not so much.
Maybe some people don't know this is art or this is like a decoration.
Artist Ong Myate helped create the sound suit. He's also the co-founder of what he says is the country's only contemporary art school.
By the previous government, it's never come up that kind of work in the public, I'm sure.
During 50 years of military rule, Myanmar artists were stifled by censorship. They've only recently gotten room to experiment, but there's still self-censorship, especially around taboo topics like religion and ethnic conflict. Terrain Tan Cha says making art about sensitive topics will take time. For now, he's content to highlight problem areas like noise.
Most of the people in Myanmar, they met everyday noise. I just want to point out, that's all. Yeah.
Maybe once people hear what they sound like, he says, then they'll reduce the noise.
A little bit reduced is much better.
For the world, Lainey Baron, Yangon.
And that's Our World for this Tuesday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.